Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today I am, I know I say I'm excited every time I record a podcast episode, but I am genuinely excited, but I'm even more excited today. And I'll explain why in a minute. But I have the wonderful Cherie on today, who is a doula and has set up the Asian Birth Collective. And we're here today to talk about the Asian Birth Collective and Asians in pregnancy and birth and why that collective is necessary. So welcome, Cherie.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk to you. Do you want to, before we dive into our topic for today, do you want to just introduce yourself to everybody that's listening?
Sure. My name is Cherie. I am currently living in Oakland, California. I am a queer, genderqueer, postpartum doula and photographer. And I've been doing this work for the last 4 years. And I'm the co-founder of the Asian Birth Collective that started, I think, in 2020. So the work that I do here, a lot of it is cultural postpartum care, which follows sort of my roots and my lineage. A lot of it is ancestral knowledge. I identify as Singaporean Peranakan Chinese, which is like a specific subset of Chinese people. And so I always make that clear, because then my cultural care is not necessarily traditional Chinese in that way. And that's what I do. And a lot of my spare time goes into building the Asian Birth Collective, connecting with people like yourself, Erin, you know, in the US and around the world, and just trying to bring more attention to Asian birthing world, if you will.
Yeah, which I think is so important. And before we started recording, I said to you how important I think it is to have a representation, because I don't feel like there is very much representation or prominent, you know, birth workers or, you know, places or spaces for Asian pregnant people or Asian birth workers. And I do feel like there is a definite need for something like the Asian Birth Collective, because you're getting together all of these amazing Asian birth workers and providing a resource and a reference place for people who are pregnant, who identify as Asian, to find and seek out, you know, Asian birth workers. So I applaud you for setting it up. And that's why I got so excited, because I don't see very many Asian birth workers, you know, on Instagram or social media in general. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you set up the Asian Birth Collective and why you think it's so important?
Yeah, exactly. So much of what you said, you know, when I was pregnant with my first two children, almost 8 and 5.5 years ago, I was looking for an Asian doula for myself, and specifically an Asian postpartum doula, because in our culture and in many cultures, food is so important as part of the recovery process. And genuinely, I was just craving home food throughout my whole pregnancy that I just had to cook for myself. And I knew that once the baby would be here, I would just want all the soups and all the congees and all the herbal teas that I've seen my mom make for my cousins, you know, my aunties and my grandmothers. And I just really wanted that for myself. But I didn't want the rules that came with it. You know, there's a lot of I didn't want a confinement nanny to really tell me what I couldn't do. And we live in the Bay Area of California, Northern California, and you know, we're quite a diverse population here. So I was really surprised that even out here, I couldn't find a single Asian doula. And so after the birth of my second child, just feeling really, and I think a lot of people who have had doulas at their birth just feel like, oh, I couldn't have done it without my doula. And I felt that really strongly because it almost ended up in an emergency C-section. I was minutes away from, I gave birth to her in the operating room, essentially. And so just this strong feeling of like everyone deserves this sort of care. There has to be more Asian people like me, whether immigrant or not, you know, Asian Americans and immigrant Asian people who are caught in this East meets West world where we want some of our roots and some of our culture and traditions, but maybe not all of it. Or even if you do want all of it, someone to be able to guide you and support you through that. And so I went into this work. And as I was taking my birth doula training, I sat there, one of three Asian trainees in this class of, I don't know, 15 to 20 people. And I was quite taken aback by being a person of color in a room full of non, let's just say white, it's a room full of white people. And I think there's a lot to be said about that because I think as Asian people, we are often taught to be quiet, blend in, be as invisible as you can. And so in group settings like that, I just tend to go that way. I'm like, just don't ruffle feathers. Don't, your opinion is not important. And so that was really challenging for me. The facilitators of this course were amazing and they were really encouraging and there were community agreements and they really held a really safe space that allowed me to try to open up. But this just sitting there and just thinking, oh, shouldn't there be a space just for us? And also, once I'm done with this training, how do I seek out other Asian doulas, whether they're starting off or maybe they've been established? Like, I want a way to keep connecting with more people. And so, as I sat there daydreaming and really sometimes not paying attention because of my ADHD, just, you know, the idea was born of like, oh, there should be a platform where we can all connect, you know, and hopefully people start hearing the word about this. I mean, I didn't have a name for it then, but hearing about the platform and just being like, oh, this is a way for birthing people and birth workers to reach out to each other. And so once the training was done, I walked up to my two Asian course mates. I was like, hi, you don't know me, but I have this great idea. Do you want to do it with me? And they jumped on board. They were like, yeah, that sounds amazing. And everyone that I talked to about it said it was amazing. And so that kept me going. And so we created the website. You know, when it started, and it still is pretty simple. It really is just an online directory. For folks to just come and be like, oh, is there a Philippine doula in Portland, Oregon, who can cook me postpartum food, or you know, and so slowly but surely it grew, and we now have maybe over 60 people listed on our directory. Yeah, so that's how it kind of started, and it's continuing to grow.
And it's growing because it's needed, right? There's obviously a need and a desire for, this kind of resource. And I think it's interesting when you were talking about, being Asian but wanting to pick and choose from, the cultural traditions and the things that we tend to do for postpartum. And I that resonates with me, as I'm half Chinese, half Irish. But my Chinese side of the family are very westernized because they're not first generation immigrants. They basically they're first generation South African Chinese, and my grandparents are from China. And so the traditions and the culture is different and it's changed, and it's, we take the bits that we've been passed down from our grandparents, and some of it has been adapted and it's been mishmashed of South African culture and, obviously British culture. And I still want some of that, my mum still made me, the chicken and wine soup after I gave birth, right? Which was amazing,
Yum.
and there's certain dishes that I crave, which are very traditional. But I didn't want to do confinement. I didn't want to not wash my hair for however many
I
weeks.
didn't either. I don't blame you. I did not either.
But and it's hard, right? I feel it as from being mixed race and from being from a very westernized family, being able to seek out other Asian birth workers who would have been able to support me, who, and finding that diversity and finding somebody who's kind of more open-minded and happy to kind of accommodate and adjust, do a mishmash of, some of the more, Western things that we do and some of the Asian things. And I think it's amazing that you've brought all these people together so that that's easier to find, because that's hard. I mean, that just finding, I think just finding an Asian postpartum doula in the UK, I think is hard, to be honest. I don't think there's masses of them here anyway. And I think, like I said earlier, Asian representation is scarce in the birth world. And I don't really understand why, because there's obviously lots of us. I'm sure there's lots of us.
You
But
know, it's funny. Someone asked me that question recently. Someone said, "Why do you think there are so few Asian doulas?" And I think, we exist, but obviously in very small numbers, as we've talked about. And I do wonder how much of it is because it's also not necessarily a career that our families would encourage us to pursue. Because, I mean, let's be real, it's a tough job. The burnout rate is so high for doulas. I think the burnout rate here is like 2 years. And I think with midwives, it's like 5 to 10 years or something. And so the burnout rate is high. The pay, depending on where you live, is not very good. It's not valued in the way that it should be because, it's not a 9 to 5 job. But I think, yeah. And so I went in considering why is it there's not a lot of birth doulas or postpartum doulas. I just don't think it's. I think a lot of, like, I was worried about what my parents would say, like, oh, I'm gonna do this thing, and they were very supportive and they were great, but I could see the sort of like question mark of like, why would you want to do that? And most postpartum care traditionally is by confinement nannies or these aunties, these Asian aunties who have basically done it their whole lives, right? But they live in for a whole month. And so, yeah, I wonder if that's also one of the reasons why there's not that many Asian doulas.
I guess it's probably, you're right, it's probably not a typical career that a lot of Asian parents would want their daughters or their children to go for. So yeah, maybe that is why. But I just think it's interesting that although we are a minority in the UK, Chinese or Asian is a minority. If you think globally, we're the majority, right?
Yes, exactly.
And there is so much migration going on in the world. And I just think your collective can only grow, I think. And even if we are kind of Asian birth workers, and I'm in the UK and you're in the US, and there's probably, birth workers from all over the globe, the internet has made, connecting so much easier and sharing knowledge so much easier, that I think it's still a real benefit to be able to connect with other birth workers, or to have a space where you can ask questions, or you can, find people who maybe have experiences or backgrounds similar to you. Because I think that's, again, with birth particularly, like we've already talked about some of the Asian traditions, which I think maybe an English doula or an American doula who hasn't dealt with Asian families may not, understand or be able to do some of those things for you. So I think it's amazing that you've set up these set up the collective. I think it's really, really, really important. It's funny. I was talking to my daughter at the weekend because it's just Halloween just gone, right? And it just makes me think about the importance of representation because she was saying to me, "Oh, I don't want to go trick or treating." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because," and she's obsessed with reading book characters. There's no Asian book characters that look like me. She didn't want to dress up for Halloween. And I was like, oh, I thought she's right. There isn't. I mean, if you think about, Asian, prominent Asian representation in film and TV, like it's not there really. And I said so to her, you can dress up as anybody, but she's like, I want to dress up as someone that looks like me. Which I get, right? So
Yes.
when
Oh,
I
but that breaks my heart. It
I
just
know
breaks my heart.
it broke my heart. But when I see other Asian birth workers and I see you setting up, this collective, it just resonates with me how important it is. Because even as a grown adult, I saw you and your collective and my heart did little, little dance. I was like, oh my God. I'm not detracting from all my other amazing birth worker friends that I have.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. I speak to all of them on a daily basis. I have WhatsApp groups and I have an amazing network. But meeting other Asian doulas and other Asian birth workers for me is really important because we have culturally, different. You have that instant understanding, right?
Yes.
There's things that, we will have grown up with and kind of cultural differences, which I think resonate with somebody who has kind of a similar background.
Yeah, I think it speaks a lot for, just being able to be in a space with someone without having to feel like you are second guessing yourself, or you need to explain where you're coming from, or you're worried that maybe what you're saying is inappropriate or confusing, any number of things. And I think that's also why I started the Asian Birth Collective is not just for like solely Asian people. There's so many biracial, multiracial people out there. I've had birth workers come to me and say like, oh, is it okay if I'm part of the collective because I'm only like 1/10 Asian? Am I mostly not Asian? And to that I always say like, it doesn't matter how much Asian you are. We're not gatekeeping here. We're not screening you for like what percentage of your ethnicity is Asian. It's like if that is something that calls to you, if you feel like your Asian heritage and the roots to which you come from are a big part of who you are and speak to you, and there's so much to be said for ancestral knowledge that's just passed down through our DNA, through our, the way we interact with our families, like that is so much of it, and so like I want to say to like all Asian birth workers out there, like it doesn't matter how much Asian you are, and like the imposter syndrome is real. So many people are like, oh, but I don't know enough. I don't really know because I wasn't really taught. Or like you said, like, oh, my parents, they're not really from China. We're kind of, generational, live somewhere else. And it's like it just feels like you're not allowed to own it, which in some part infuriates me because we see appropriation happen, right? Appropriation from people who are not Asian or their roots are not in any of the cultural things that we practice, and they're happy to own it and sell it and market it and repackage it and make it really pretty and make lots of money from it. And then when we come out and we're like, hey, I do this thing my grandmother sort of taught me, we kind of have to hide, we have to fight a little harder to sell ourselves. And it's kind of ridiculous. It shouldn't be that way. And I'm really hoping to change that narrative. Even for myself, when I first started, I was like, should I say I'm a confinement doula? Should I say that I'm a cultural doula? Is that okay? Because it wasn't taught to me in this way where someone opened a book or someone sat me down and said, these are the step-by-step things you do in postpartum. I watched my mom, I watched my aunts, I watched my grandmothers and my cousins, you know, like I have a big family in Singapore. Like I, one aunt and uncle have 11 kids, you know, like I have a huge family. And so that when they had kids and I, it's the norm, right? In Singapore, practicing confinement is the norm. And so I hear about it. And then when I'm here, when I started practicing here, it was just like, I felt iffy. And I was like, but I don't have a certification. I haven't done training.
I need one, you know, because that's how our traditions are handed down, right? From
Right.
being like when, you know, my pawpaw doesn't, she doesn't write recipes down,
No.
right? Like I would stand here and watch her, me and my mum would watch her make a soup or a dish, and you'd turn around and she'd slip something else in, and you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa,
Yes.
you just put it in the pot. And she was like, oh, just a bit of this. And I'm like, well, how much? She was like, I don't know. So you just have to keep on taste testing until it
Yeah.
tastes right, and just watch her like a hawk, because you don't know otherwise. She just slips ingredients in, or she tries to like mix things up and like change the recipe, and you're like, no, don't change things up, like stick to but that's how we learn, that's how our traditions are handed down. It's by watching and doing, right? It's not by doing a course or studying notes or things. It's practical things. It's generational traditions being handed down from watching our grandmothers and our mothers, and again, it resonates with me as someone who's mixed, and not I don't speak Chinese. I don't, I could only speak English. If I could speak Chinese, it wouldn't be Mandarin or Cantonese, because my grandmother's Hakka. And owning that Asian side of me, when outwardly I look quite Asian and I look quite Chinese, but I'm not Asian enough for a lot of Asians to validate me as Asian, but I don't look white enough to fit in with the white people either. You end up kind of floundering a little bit, like, I don't belong here and I don't belong here. And can I say that I know these things with birth work? And can I say that I know these cultural practices? Because I'm not, I was going to say I'm not properly Asian. I am. But that's almost a slip of the tongue. That's kind of, it just shows how, as somebody who's mixed and has been brought up in the UK, it kind of the imposter syndrome comes through, right? And you kind of feel like you can't own your Asianness. And again, it's hugely validating for me to hear you talking about, we're not gatekeeping here, and you can own your Asianness, and you can talk about these things, like, oh yes. It's so nice to hear someone say that.
I'm so glad. And I also want to say that I acknowledge my position as someone who grew up in Asia is very different than Asian Americans or, you know, folks like you who grew up in the UK. Like my position and the things that have affected me growing up, they're different than yours, right? And I've spoken with a lot of, I have a lot of Asian American friends here, and I acknowledge that, like, it's harder for them in some ways to own that quote unquote Asianness, right? And so I am also learning from them the difficulties that they face. Like I didn't experience racism growing up because Chinese people are the majority in Singapore, and I grew up within an Asian context, right? That's not to say that racism doesn't exist in Singapore. That's a whole other conversation. But I do wanna state that, like, that's an important distinction. And I think that I've also made with my Asian American friends, like your upbringing and how you grew up, that affects so much, right? Where many of them were one of maybe the only Asian person in school, or they were made fun of for their lunches and things like that. Like I've never experienced that. And so I don't have that sort of trauma, if you will.
Yeah.
And so the point of it is all that we're learning. Like, I'm not here to give anyone permission either, but I think there's so much to be said for community, sitting together, learning from each other, and just being graceful in this world where we're just going all the time. And it's like the more of everything, like just sitting together for a minute and being graceful and accepting that, yeah, okay, we're here. You know, we had our very first Asian Birth Collective in-person event on Sunday. First one after so many years. It was a long time coming. And, you know, it was intimate and it was sweet. There was 9 of us in total. We all sat there and we had community agreements before we started of like, you know, we're here to listen. We're here to learn from each other, things like that. And we just sat there and we were together. And by the end of it, almost everyone said, wow, that's like a breath of fresh air. You know, being able to just be yourself without having to worry about being gaslit or second guessed and all those things. It, my soul was overjoyed, and just I woke up the next day feeling so invigorated and really feeling even more passionate about the Asian Birth Collective and where we're going, and you know, trying to think up all the ways of reaching more people everywhere.
Yeah. And one thing that we haven't really talked about, so we've talked about from the birth worker side, but from the pregnant person side as well, I think the collective is really important, because racism in maternity care is very prevalent, despite people saying that it doesn't exist, which just blows my mind because it does. And obviously we have, you know, we have lots of stats in the UK. We have these, you know, these embrace reports that get published every year, looking at the rates of harm that are inflicted on Black and Brown people and Asian people. And it's far worse for Black and Brown pregnant women and people than it is for Asians. But I do feel like, as a Asian woman myself, having an Asian birth worker to support me who understands how I personally would be perceived potentially, and the misconceptions and the assumptions and the stereotypes that exist around Asian people, I think would be really helpful, because there are definite misconceptions and stereotypes that are attributed to being Asian, and you know, and you've already mentioned some of them today, you know, earlier. You know, that we are expected to be quiet and submissive and not speak up, and that we're not going to be any problem. You know, we're going to be, you know, easy to deal with because we're Asian, for example. And then there's physical, you know, assumptions that are made very, very often with Asian people. Like, for example, all of my children were classed as small gestational age. I didn't even realize until I requested my birth notes after I had my third child. Absolutely bonkers. I'm 5'1" and I'm Asian. My children were not going to be massive. But I was induced with my first because she was classed as small gestational age. And obviously they thought, get her out earlier, which is completely bonkers. But I've had so many people message me going, oh, I've been told that my pelvis is really small. And they're suggesting that I have an induction or a C-section. So there is definite specific biases and racist assumptions and, you know, treatments that are attributed to Asians, which I think is maybe not quite understood by somebody who isn't Asian or hasn't dealt with lots of Asian pregnant people, possibly. I mean, what's your view on that? What do you think?
You know, it's funny. I think there's probably also a population of Asian people who choose not to believe that racism affects them.
Mm-hmm.
That also goes along with the be quiet, you know, like if I stay invisible enough and follow the rules enough, then I can blend in with the white people. right? And so there's a belief that, like, well, they're not being racist, they're just being nice. Like, how many of us have heard that before? They're not being racist, they're just being nice. No, it's racist. If you think it's racist. I am not a small Asian person, so I'm 5'4", 5'5", you know, but I'm not what people perceive as this typical petite, tiny, quote unquote, Asian woman. And so I didn't have that assumption about being too petite. Although with my first child, when I was pregnant and I was worried about gestational diabetes, because, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on that. And I was talking to my OBGYN and I was like, oh, I'm just, you know, just sharing my concerns, not that it was legitimate issue. And the first thing she said to me was, well, you should stop eating rice. And
So what?
I was so shocked. I couldn't even respond because I was like, what? That's your first response is, oh, you're worried about GD, stop eating white rice. W would you have said that to a white person? And also, I've been eating rice my whole life since I was born. I think I'm going to be just fine. Thank you very much. I think white rice is going to be the least of my concerns, you know, and so that's just to say there's so much unconscious bias, microaggressions that happen. The pelvis issue is, like, I think the biggest one for Asian bodies, especially if you present as petite. It's ridiculous. But
It
also, we've grown up with people telling us, you know, aunties, grandmothers, cousins, oh, you have really good birthing hips, or you don't have good birthing hips, you're going to have a hard time with childbirth. And so we've internalized that idea as well. And so then when it's presented to us by a medical professional, then it must be a real thing. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And I think the what pregnant Asian people have to do is really, like, educate themselves, right? Understanding your pelvic floor. Like, there's so much more that goes into why your baby would be stuck, and how big the size of your hips are is not at all one of them. Not at all. Because you don't know what it looks like on the inside. And you know, I've done some Instagram posts on it, and I've had responses where people are like, oh, but my baby did get stuck. So what happened? You know, it's like the symmetry of your pelvis, the size of your pelvic floor, and the
Position
muscles,
the baby
yeah,
was in,
a position that you were in exactly, and, like, where you induce, it's like everything affects it except the size of your hips. And I think so many providers just see, like, oh, tiny Asian woman, baby's gonna get stuck.
It's bonkers because does ev I mean, do we have extremely high rates of dystocia in Asia? Like, no. Does every single person in Asia end up with a C-section because their babies get stuck? No.
And also, are our bodies just going to grow babies we cannot birth?
Exactly. No. It's crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And I think it's just one more reason for medical providers to push induction, right? It's an excuse. It's very convenient. It scares us into thinking, well, something's going to go wrong, so I better listen, because it sounds medical. But the thing is, the way they estimate the size of the baby is completely inaccurate. And that's what they don't tell you, right? The providers don't sit there, measure your baby, and say, well, actually, plus or minus 15% here or there, I could be completely wrong. And, you know, so many of my clients who were Asian people were induced, and because baby might be too big, and then the baby comes out 6 pounds or something, and it's perfectly average weight for a baby. And it's just one more thing in the birthing world that tells us not to trust ourselves.
Yeah. And my other issue is growth charts. Like all of my kids are right down the bottom of those centiles. My Daisy, I mean, she's not growing. She's 8 and she looks like a 6-year-old, 5-year-old. But she's dropped off the bottom of the chart, but she's always been at the bottom of the chart. And I think, as again, it's quite common, I think, with Asian pregnant people to have their fundal height measurements and their scans and get told your baby's at the 10th centile or under the 10th centile. Oh, alarm bells, your baby's really small. We need to induce you. There's something wrong with the baby. And actually, the baby's tracking along their line perfectly fine. They're just at the bottom of the cent. And all it means, if you're on the 10th centile or your baby's on the 10th centile, is that out of 100% of babies, 10% of them are going to be smaller than, and the 90% of them are going to be bigger. You've got to be somewhere on that chart. Doesn't necessarily mean it's an issue if you're at the bottom of the chart. Just the same as if your baby was on the 90th centile and they tracked all the way on the 90th centile, and you're 6 foot and your partner's 7 foot. Your baby's going to be way off the scale because it's genetics, right?
Exactly. I mean, I don't know how they do it in the UK. Does it follow the WHO chart as well?
So they
Or is
have,
it like a UK?
yeah, I think they probably have something similar. So yeah, they have like the different centiles and they plot the growth on these different centile lines.
Yeah, we have that too, but it's based off the WHO chart. And so it's this huge population of babies because it's the World Health Organization. So in Singapore, and I might be completely wrong, but this is what I've been told, they follow a local chart because Asian babies aren't gonna match up to white babies who may or may not be bigger. Like, where the average is not gonna work out. It's just not gonna work out. And like you said, for an Asian body, if you're petite and 5'1" and your fundal height isn't measuring accordingly, or your baby, like if you're presenting too small, then you're in trouble. Or you're on the other end of the spectrum where then now your baby's too big to come out. There's no in between.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? It's really crazy.
It
And
is.
even if they use ethnic appropriate charts, we're still trying to standardize something that is not standard. I'm 5 foot 1, you're 5 foot 5, we're both Asian. Our babies are going to be on different places on growth charts because
Absolutely.
my husband is from Hong Kong. He's fairly short. Our kids were never going to be really big. Whereas if I had have married somebody who, for example, was white and 6 foot, that's going to affect where my child probably sits on the growth chart because of their ethnicity. I think even if we are using, localized charts, growth charts, I think there's still issues, right? Because we're still trying to average out something and standardize something that is not standard. We are all unique.
Yes, and genetics are funny. You just never know how it's going to go.
So yeah, I think there's a multitude of different assumptions that I think are made when it comes to Asian pregnant people, and I think some people don't even realize. I mean, I'm Asian. I did not realize with any of my pregnancies actually that maybe I was kind of being racially profiled, in my pregnancy because of how small my children were. And I wish someone had flagged it with me because I had a terrible birth with my first. I had postnatal depression for the first, 12 months. Which affected me all the way through all three of my births and postnatally. And if someone had have said to me, "Hold on a minute, that induction's not necessarily because actually you're Asian, you're small, and your baby's probably actually fine because they're just small," and you might, do some research and think about whether you want to go ahead with that induction. And I hadn't done it. Things might have been different. So I think it's in getting that message out there, I think is really, really important as well. Educating people, A, about their choices and their rights and, you know, all the things that I shout about on my Instagram. But also that as somebody who is not white, you're contending with a whole load of other challenges, which a white person will not have to contend with when it comes to assumptions and medical recommendations and, you know, procedures that are kind of forced on you potentially because of your racial background.
You know, as I was preparing for this podcast, just thinking of some of the things like, you know, the misconceptions that Asian people face. One of the things that I've heard kind of go around that I think is a myth or a belief in the medical world is that Asian people have shorter perineums, which then lead to greater risk of episiotomies and so I was Googling this, and there have been studies that have been done on basically the belief that Asian people are at greater risk for tearing during a vaginal delivery, which blows my mind. Like Reuters released an article titled "Asians at Greater Risk for Tear During Delivery." And I just sat there and I read this article and went, based on what? Actually, based on what? Based on a couple of studies that were done with a very small population of actual Asian people. The study wasn't based on actual people. The study was based on like 32,000 birthing people, but 20% of them were Asian. That was the study. And it was like, oh, Asian people are Southeast Asian. And then South Asian people are 2.1% and 2.5% more likely to have third or fourth degree tears.
I have so much to say about this because it makes me really cross. Because there is okay, there is a multitude of reasons why somebody tears. And if you're going to do a study where you have not probably factored into and considered their birthing position and where they've given birth and how they've given birth and whether they were induced and, you know, whether they had forceps and, you know, or whether they were doing home. I mean, if we had a study looking at lots of different ethnicities and they all had unmedicated, hands-off home births, okay, maybe that might show something. But otherwise, there's going to be flawed, right? Because if you're birthing in hospital and you had synthetic oxytocin and you're on your back, and you're being guided to push, it's unsurprising that you've ended up with a tear, right? So the statistics are probably are going to be flawed. But like how that's bonkers. That study makes me angry.
It makes me even more angry that someone like Reuters then published an article with such an awful headline. It's not informative at all, and also it's not factual.
No.
It's not factual just because the study said so. You know, studies are more often than not flawed. They're very skewed, and it's, you know, I'm not very good at research, but I think I can get the gist of it, you know. And oh, episiotomies, and you know, and I think with everything that we've talked about, all the assumptions and misconceptions, then that also leads to more interventions, which then lead to the tearing, which is exactly what you just said, which is not what they're considering at all. And I think on top of that, you know, especially immigrant Asian people, there's an assumption that English is not their native language. And especially if you have any kind of accent when you speak, then you are treated like the other. You're treated differently. They suddenly change the way they speak. They slow down. They don't explain things in detail. They've used simple English, and that's racist. That's just big time racist. And I've seen that happen with my clients, particularly Black and Brown Asian clients. You know, South Asian clients who come to the Bay for work, and there's a lot of them, and they have strong accents. It doesn't mean they don't understand you. It doesn't mean they can't speak the language. And I've just seen providers speak to them like they're children
Oh, in fact,
as they're having contractions. If you speak to anyone during a contraction, they're not going to hear you. It doesn't matter how you speak.
because you're in labor, you're having a contraction.
Exactly. And it's like, and as you're lecturing someone who's in the midst of active labor, what do you think is going to happen? Nobody's going to comprehend your lecture of like, well, you should do this, you should do that. I mean, you shouldn't be doing that in the first place. And so, yeah, language, I think, is another big challenge that I think many people don't consider before they receive care, that can often be the first step of like unconscious bias or microaggression.
And I think language actually is a really important point, because there will be lots of Asian pregnant people who maybe English isn't their first language. And how do we support those people so that they are well informed and so that they are getting the information they need to make, good decisions for them and their baby? And again, having maybe a doula who speaks your native tongue but also speaks English so they can support you in that way, or advocate for you or understand, some of those how to navigate that, that medical system and support you in that way. Again, I think is really, really important. I wish everybody could have a doula, to be perfectly honest. White, Asian, doesn't actually matter. Because I think having somebody who is knowledgeable and is used to working with, so in the UK, the NHS system, for example, and understand the policies and the guidelines and the way that we do things here, and whether that fits with your cultural beliefs or fits with what you just want or what you think is best for you. I think that's really important. And even more so if English isn't your first language, because that's just another layer of complication and barrier for you getting the birth that you deserve, to be honest, if you don't speak English as a first language.
I mean, first of all, I think all medical providers should be doing more for people whose English is not their first language. There should be interpreters. It shouldn't be imposed. No one should feel forced or feel like they have to make a choice because they don't understand what's happening. But that happens, right? They're intimidated into making a choice, not necessarily because they want to give consent, but because they have to. Coupled with the fact that as Asian people, we're taught to just say yes and go along with. You know, that's just so many layers there. And you know, so like for the people who can't afford to have doulas, who aren't able to find a doula, they're the ones who struggle, and they're the ones who receive inadequate care, and they're the ones who end up with lots of interventions and complications postpartum and things like that. And it shouldn't be that way. But for the people who are considering doulas, you know, one of the things I always say is anybody can be a doula. Like I understand there's a lot. There's a, you know, being certified and trained as a doula, there's a lot that comes with that, the knowledge and the experience and things like that. But if you can't afford to have a doula, anyone can be a doula. Your friend can be your doula, someone who just can hold space for you and remind you of the things that you want because it is your birth. You know, and then educating yourself. You know, as much as we want to trust the medical system, I think there are some people who go into hospital birth because it feels safer, which is fine. It's everyone's choice to birth wherever they want to. If you feel better having your birth at a hospital, that's your choice and that's okay. But it's still important to be educated to understand the process that's going to happen and that every step of the way you have the right to give consent or to remove consent. And you have the right to say, I don't want this provider in my room. Like you get to call the shots. And I think the medical system has just made us feel like they take away our power. The moment we step through those doors, they've taken away your power. Change into this gown, strip naked in front of me, open your legs. We're gonna do a cervical check, which really indicates nothing, right? Cervical checks do nothing for anyone except cause a lot of discomfort. And for some people, it's just extremely traumatic. So like educating yourself doesn't mean you don't trust the system, it means that you can trust yourself so much more. And having a doula who speaks multiple languages, even if you understood English, having a doula who can speak in your native language can be so comforting. I had a Taiwanese client, and she was amazing. And she had a home birth, and I was there for the birth, and it was amazing. And there was just something that felt like if I spoke to her in Mandarin while she was in active labor, it would reach a part of her that English wouldn't necessarily reach. My Mandarin's not that great, but I can say encouraging things. And so that's what I did as she was really, in the depths of labor and at some point struggling here and there, I spoke to her in Mandarin. And after the birth was over, she said to me, "Wow, that made such a difference for me. And like, thank you for doing that." And that made me feel good that my Chinese education paid off in that moment. And that's why on our directory, on our online directory, when we have people come through, we ask them what their ethnicity is, what their cultural background is, and what languages they speak, because there are people who need cultural care and support with language and things like that.
But it's so true. It's funny, because as a hypnobirthing instructor, a lot of the time I talk about mind and body and how you need to switch off your conscious mind when you're birthing, because birth happens in the subconscious. And you're right, I've never actually thought about it, but language, if English is not your first language and you're having to converse, which you shouldn't have to be doing anyway in the middle of labor, but if you are having to converse and you're conversing in a language that is not your native tongue, you are having to think so much harder to in order to have that conversation than if you were speaking in your mother tongue. It just blows my mind that I've never thought of that before. But you're right, it's unsurprising that that would make such a difference to somebody, because those words are going straight into their subconscious and straight into their heart without them having to consciously translate them first into, because my husband, Cantonese is his first language, and he speaks English all day every day. But when I ask him, when he thinks in his head, he thinks in Cantonese, because that's the language that he grew up. So he's constantly having to translate things in his head, and that must be exhausting. And then when you're in labor, you don't want to be doing that on top of everything else. So yeah, I think it's fantastic. You've got this resource where people can find people who speak their native tongue or understand them on a cultural level. And you're making you're helping people connect, which I think is really amazing and really, really important. If anyone wants to find that, because we've talked a lot about it, but we haven't said how people can find you. So where can people find the Asian Birth Collective?
So we're on Instagram, Asian Birth Collective, and our website is asianbirthcollective.com. That's two ways of finding us right now. For birth workers, any Asian birth workers out there who are like, "Oh my God, I want to get in on this," it's free to be listed in our directory. It's completely free. Our main purpose is really to build community. And so there's a link there to just fill out a form, put your information on there. And for birthing people, just get on the website, and there's, birth and postpartum doulas. Right now we have a very small list of Asian midwives, so calling out all the Asian midwives out there. Health and wellness providers, so acupuncturists, herbalists, chiropractors, therapists, IBCLCs, lactation counselors, they're all needed, they're all needed. And so whoever you are, as long as you serve in the perinatal space, you work with birthing people, abortion, loss, death doulas, even any kind of provider, I think Asian Birth Collective is just going to keep growing into, I don't know, different we're going to have different limbs in a lot of things, I think, because it's just so needed. And so there's really no limits. But you know, one of the big things that we're doing right now is trying to collect Asian birth stories. Those are really hard to find. And like you said, because representation matters. You know, we see on Instagram, we see on YouTube, and we see even on TVs and movies and TV shows and all that stuff. Like, you don't really see an Asian person giving birth, which goes back into the taboo and the stigma of talking about birth. Like, there's just, I think Asian cultures in general are quite private. You know, you don't air your dirty laundry, you keep everything private, don't talk about bad things, especially. That's even worse. You know, there's a lot of superstition and things like that. And I think if we talk more about it and we normalize it, then it reaches more people who are maybe experiencing something similar. And like you said, if someone had told you, for example, these are the things to look out for during your first birth and how you might have been misconceived, like, you would have gone into that birth a little bit differently. And so if that helps someone else plant a seed in someone else's head or anything, or maybe someone else has already had a traumatic birth and they're listening to someone who has experienced the same thing, that just, it really helps our heart, you know. And I would love to encourage more Asian people to talk about birth, to talk about postpartum, to talk about loss. You know, it's not taboo, it is not shameful. And I can understand why it is, but we're here to hold space together because we're all experiencing it. We don't need to rely on our white counterparts. Like, I think it's great, whatever is happening in the birth world. Like, you know, I think it's, I don't mean anything bad, but I think it's important to have our own space, and we need to own that. And also for Asian birth workers to own the label Asian. I think part of the being invisible is not calling ourselves Asian, if that makes sense. So one of the first things that I did when I started this work was my hashtag was Asian doula, Asian doula, Asian doula. There were no posts for Asian doula. And now there's so much more, and it's just like, it's okay to own it. Sometimes I think we think we're not allowed to think we're people of color. But we're perceived that way, and we experience racism, and there's a lot of issues.
Oh, I'm so grateful for you giving up your time to chat today. I feel like, I feel like the conversation could go in a million different different, you know, avenues. But I thank you so much for chatting today. I think it's hugely important. I'll make sure I put all the links in the show notes so that people can find you. And I hope other Asian birth workers find this episode and find you and submit listings so the collective continues growing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.